He turns tonight to Job chapter 38. 38th chapter of Job, beginning with the first verse. It is the turning point in the book of Job, because God finally speaks. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man. I will question you, and you make it known to me." We've been waiting for this moment for a long time. The Lord finally interrupts everything. One of the first points to notice is that He interrupts in His own sovereign time as well as His own sovereign way. Have you ever noticed how He interrupts your life and gets your attention in His own sovereign time? You and I might have thought that immediately after Job had given his last speech and had simply said, "Here's my signature, let the Almighty answer me," that that would have been the moment for God to answer him. But instead, we find that it was very appropriate to have the words of Elihu, who, angry young man though he was, knew something about God, and even though he did not know enough about Job to be able to characterize him accurately, he at least tried his best to use Job's own words. And in the things that he said about God, particularly chapters 36 and 37, he kind of gave us a bridge to the right moment in which God finally answers. Now, most of you have read the book of Job before, and we're going to go through this chapter tonight, but first of all, it is wise to just say from the very beginning that there are some things that are absolutely impossible to do justice to, and this chapter is one of them. I mean, we might as well display one of Rembrandt's paintings up here and try to dissect it brushstroke by brushstroke, or, you know, play a great piece of music and try to analyze it note by note. This is a magnificent chapter, and it is far above any minister or commentator's ability to do justice to. However, the first thing to ask ourselves about it is the phenomena that we're going to face and what it's going to be telling us about God. Because I don't suppose that there would be anyone here who would say that this chapter contains an answer from God like you might expect. In other words, if you considered yourself to be completely bereft of all your belongings and wealth, your children dead, your wife embittered, your body afflicted with boils and sores, your sleep haunted by dreams, and your friends criticizing you, judging you, and pointing their fingers at you, accusing you of secret sin, and here you are, friendless and scraping yourself with a potsherd and crying out to God because you know that there hasn't been anything that you have done that has brought this on. Here is the question before us. Would we expect God to answer us this way? No. No, we would not expect God to answer us this way. We, as parents, would not answer our own child this way if our child was crying out for help or understanding. We, as husbands, would not answer our wives this way. We, as friends, would not probably answer a friend this way. This is one of the high and holy things about God, the way that he answers Job, with whom, do not forget, he has great sympathy. He has been the one to point out to Satan in chapter 1 how proud he is of Job. And we would not have expected his answer to be this way, because his answer is going to consist of a barrage of questions. Questions that would shut the mouth of anybody, because they're questions about himself, his power, his sovereignty, his complete control over all the created order, his sovereignty even over the mythological. He's going to use poetic language. He's going to use language of great vividness, but not once is he ever going to mention boils, friends, wealth, children, potsherds, or anything else that Job has been dealing with for weeks. He's not going to mention Job's problems at all. Not word one. He's not going to say anything that even acknowledges that he has watched Job. Now, he's saying some things that acknowledges he's listened to Job. But he's not going to say anything to him about the suffering that he, with his compassionate eyes, has seen and that he himself has ordained. He's not going to be telling Job what Job has asked for. Job wants an explanation. He wants some case presented to him as if he were in a courtroom and he's ready to present his back to God. And God's not even going to go there. He's not going to indulge him. He's not going to give him any kind of give-and-take courtroom scene. Furthermore, he's not going to tell him about the situation between himself and Satan. He's not going to let Job know what in the world has been going on. This is one of the things that I think sets the book apart from the merely human. This is one of the things that I think makes it so very clear that this is a divinely written, divinely constructed book, because it doesn't play by the rules that you and I know make for good literature. It doesn't have the kind of ending where everything gets all neatly wrapped up and Job finds out what was going on all the time. Because, of course, if Job had found out what was going on all the time, he would have said, "Oh, you mean that was it? You mean Satan challenged you? You mean this was a display of my faithfulness? You mean you were showing my life to the principalities and powers? You mean you were there all the time watching and seeing if I were going to respond in faith? Well, now I understand. Why didn't you say so?" We don't get any of that in the book of Job. And so one of the things that we've got to figure out tonight as we read this chapter is, what is God doing here? What is he doing in the way that he answers Job? Let's begin with just reading quickly through the first 11 verses. There's much matter here, but we're going to read through it, then stop and talk about individual lines. "Who is this that darkens counsel in words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man." The old King James version is "gird up your loins," and it's what Elijah did when he ran ahead of Ahab's chariot when rain was about to come. It was a way of getting yourself ready for action so that you could move about. Perhaps the NIV catches the idea with "brace yourself." Certainly that's what Job should have done right before he got this. But I think that there's a significance beyond "brace yourself." I think that there's a significance in speaking of girding up your loins like a man or dress for action like a man, what do you think might be the further significance of that? Is there anything else that that might suggest to you? What if God appeared to you or His voice was made known to your mind and said, "All right, hitch up your belt. Tighten up your skirt, ladies." What does that mean? Buckle up, but it also means stand up. I'm going to talk to you like an adult. I'm going to talk to you like a man. I'm going to talk to you like a woman. I'm going to talk to you like a human being capable of understanding. In other words, there is a certain compliment here to Job. He is saying, stand up. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to say that God is going to talk to him man to man. But he is going to talk to him as one who is responsible, with whom he is concerned. He's not going to treat him like a little child. He's basically saying, stand up and dress for action. I will question you and you declare to me. You make it known to me. Okay. As I say, you're there covered with boils. You are in the greatest depression of your life. You are in the throes of affliction. And God says this to you. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. Have any idea what God is doing? That is a very good statement. In other words, Job, God is zooming in, Job is zooming out. Job is zooming out because what does happen when you're afflicted? What does happen when you're depressed? You try and try and try, but circumstances force you to be constantly thinking about yourself. Yes, exactly. And one of the things that God is doing is saying, lift up your eyes. Lift up your eyes and consider these things about me. Because Job has been, despite his best efforts, myopic in thinking about his problem and not seeing beyond that. Now, there's something else, too. Let's talk about the value of seeing beyond that. Let's talk about just the therapeutic value of it for somebody who has been wrapped up in their problems and troubles. What do you do for friends who are depressed and preoccupied with themselves? You can do a lot of things for them. You certainly can encourage them to read Scripture. You can pray for them. You can counsel with them about God. But what kinds of other things do they need? Yes, get them to focus on someone else, helping someone else. You get them a change of scenery. You give them some sort of change of scenery. Have you ever taken somebody out just for a ride or a meal who was deeply depressed or distraught just so they would begin to think about something else? And once the something else is the characteristics of God, of course, that is best of all. And that is what God is doing. He is calling on Job to hitch up his pants and stand up and to answer these mouth-shutting, unanswerable questions. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. This is a way of broadening Job's theological horizon. There's a lot of imagery here, as you know, in the first verses 4 through 6, building imagery, the imagery of a master builder. What's the line that's being talked about? Who stretched the line upon it? Well, it's actually just referring to a measuring line. It's actually referring to the kinds of lines that builders use to not only mark distances, but to get everything in order, to make things straight. On what were its bases sunk? Maybe some of your translations say footings. What are footings? Or foundations. Yeah. These are the foundations on which you're going to build a wall or build pillars or whatever you're going to build. Who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Who are the sons of God here in this passage? The angels. They're the same as the sons of God in chapter 1. The angels. And it's speaking of the angels rejoicing over God's creation. Verse 8 and 9 are both quite interesting. Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb, when I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band? If you remember the great 139th Psalm, that verb for shut in there, translated shut in the ESV, is the same verb as knit together in the great verse, for you formed my inward parts, you knitted me together in my mother's womb. This is speaking of how God birthed the sea, as if the sea had come forth out of a womb, and God made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band. The sea was his baby. It's an amazing picture. And it says that God prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors. Here again, highly poetic language, and said, thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. It's the same thing that is said in Genesis 1:10. The waters that were gathered together, he calls seas. He had said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place. And he gathered them together and he ordained their boundaries. And he said, this far you shall come and no farther. So here he is saying to Job, you've got to understand that I am the creator. I'm the author of the sea, as if the sea was birthed, and I swaddled it with thick darkness. Verses 12 through 15. Have you commanded the morning since your days began? Or let's do a little different emphasis. Have you commanded the morning since your days began? Reminding Job that he's not so old. Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? That's an interesting picture, isn't it? Because it shows the earth wrapped in a cloth, and the cloth stands for darkness and night. And of course, that's when the wicked do their evil deeds. Jesus said to those who came to arrest him in the Garden of Gethsemane, "This is your hour and the power of darkness." And what God is saying to Job here is, have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place? In other words, are you in charge of bringing sunrise? Are you in charge of making the dawn come so that it takes hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked are shaken out of it? It's like you would take a blanket or a covering and shake the wicked out of them, because light is anathema to a wicked person whose deeds are done in darkness. And then there's a different image in 14 and 15. It is changed like clay under the seal, and its features stand out like a garment, meaning that when the early morning light comes, it changes the appearance of the world. It is like the impression made on clay under a seal, or it is like a three-dimensional garment, a garment that is hanging or leaned up against the wall, and there's this three-dimensionality to the garment, and the morning shadows make that kind of appearance in the world. Then in verse 15, from the wicked, their light is withheld, and their uplifted arm is broken. Now there's going to be mixed in with the statements about God's sovereignty and power, there's going to be statements naturally about morality, about his ethics, about what he does to the good and the evil, and this is one of them, that from the wicked their light is withheld. In other words, their light is darkness. Now that darkness is over. And Jesus said in warning to Christians, he said, if the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? That's an even greater darkness, because you're supposed to be light. He says, their uplifted arm, uplifted in defiance, is broken by me. So in these first 15 verses, he talks about the foundation of the earth, the creation of the world, the making of the seas, and what he does to command the morning and the effect that that has on wicked people. What do you think would be going on in your mind if you're hearing all this from God? When what you want to know is why and how much longer? Because that's what Job wanted to know. This man is suffering, and yet he's getting all this from God. How do you think it affected him? How do you think it would affect you? Yeah, that's one thing about it. You would be ashamed for questioning him, and that will certainly come out at the beginning of chapter 40. Anything else? Yes, Laura. Yeah, and And one of the things that we're always finding out, aren't we, is that our God is too small. God is always greater than we are thinking of Him in our best estimation of Him. And this is one of the things that God wants Job to see, and it's the great lesson for all of us, that God is God. God is, in fact, God. So in verse 16, was there someone else who wants to say something? Okay, verse 16, have you entered in to the springs of the sea? Have you entered into the springs of the sea? You can imagine the idea here, the sources of water for the sea in the deepest depths, or walked in the recesses of the deep. Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Deep darkness there is the shadow of death, the same phrase that's used in Psalm 23. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. He is asking in verse 17, of course, something about how much Job knows of the afterlife, of what happens at the moment of death, and what is the destiny of the soul. Do you really know these things? Do you really understand these things? And verse 18, have you comprehended the expanse of the earth? Declare if you know all this. When he gets to verse 19, he begins to talk about the phenomena of natural elements as if he has them all in warehouses someplace. He begins to take us on a tour of God's public storage. He says, where is the way to the dwelling of light, and where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory and that you may discern the paths to its home? Do you know where to go to get the light? Are you going to be the escort of getting darkness home safely? Fantastic phrases here. That you may take it to its territory, that you may discern the paths to its home. And then the Lord says, you know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Now let's take a moment to look at verse 21. There is no question that verse 21 is sarcastic. Okay. However, does it have to be a sneer? George Bernard Shaw said, all God does is jeer at Job. Is this a jeer or a sneer? I don't think it has to be. It's obviously something designed to remind Job of how impotent and finite he is. There's no question about that. But I don't see any reason why verse 21 cannot be said with almost a twinkle in God's eye. He has told Job to stand up like a man. He is talking to him one-on-one, and this is someone he loves. This is someone that he has even exhibited to Satan as an example of righteousness. So he definitely is putting Job in his place. There's no question about it. But I'm not sure that it's necessarily any kind of insulting thing that he is saying here. That of course, is a matter of debate, but I don't think it need be. He is simply reminding Job of who is who. You know, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. And of course, Job would immediately recognize, I am of yesterday and know nothing. Yes, Bill?
In a sense, it's a great contrast there between how long Job has lived.
Yes, absolutely. So now he's gone to from speaking of the dwelling place of light and the home of darkness, and now he goes to verse 22 and says, have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? We mentioned last week about the hailstones that God sent when Joshua fought against the Amalekites in Joshua chapter 10. Well, and this word for storehouse can also be translated arsenal. So God is speaking of his arsenals of snow and the arsenals of the hail, which he has reserved for the day of battle and war. He says, what is the way to the place where the light is distributed? You and I wouldn't even have strength to shrug our shoulders that we don't know. Or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth. Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain on a land where no man is, on the desert in which there is no man, to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the ground sprout with grass? Here's an interesting idea. You notice anything particularly unusual and expanding or enlightening in your knowledge of God about what's said here in verses 25 through 27? Well, you get the impression from a lot of Christians and a lot of Christian devotional literature that God just does everything he does for human beings. That he does everything that he ever does in some sense for people. And what's this section telling us? He's sending rain on places where nobody lives to satisfy the waste and desolate land and to make the ground sprout with grass. Grass that no cattle will ever eat. Ground that no man will ever till. Maybe you've been out hiking in some very remote area and you've come upon a beautiful sight and you've wondered how many people have ever seen that before. Maybe you've even wondered if you might be the first one. And if it is beautiful, then you have to wonder at the fact that God made it beautiful when only a very, very few people would ever see it. And here, he's speaking of making things beautiful and prospering a land when nobody will see it. And this is a concept that we looked at last week. It was one of the most important contributions that Elihu made to the argument. Because, remember back in 37:13, he said that God sends the rain and to accomplish all that he commands. And he says, whether for correction or for his land or for love, he causes it to happen. And only correction and love are directly related to human beings. He's going to do things for his land for no other reason than that he wants to. So this is an amazing insight about God, that he is sending rain on a land where no man is, on the desert in which there is no man, to simply satisfy the land and to make the ground sprout with grass. Anything anybody would like to put in at this point? I don't want to just be skipping along here and have you get an insight or something and not have a chance to mention it. Job is, again, listening to all this in his suffering, but you can see that the vivid and poetic and majestic language would be such as to take his mind off of his sorrows, to lift his eyes, to lift his thoughts, to make him think about the greatness of God and the variety of God's activities and God's concerns and God's creation. This is one of the most stunning things about these chapters, the sheer number of concerns that God has and the things that are under his control. Yes, Brad. That's right. That's right. Very, very, very rightly so. This is upon this, everything else is staged. This is where God displays his power. Verse 28, has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? There were mythologies that talked about the various gods being the father of the rain and dew. And the Lord is, of course, claiming that poetic title for himself. He says in verse 29, from whose womb did the ice come forth? And who has given birth to the frost of heaven? The waters become hard like stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. Have you ever thought about the sheer fact that it would be just almost impossible for somebody in the Middle East of Job's day to know that? You know? Who in the land of Uz or ancient Israel ever saw this when the waters become hard like stone? Who ever saw a frozen lake, frozen river, and the face of the deep is frozen? This is a passage that really might have been written by divine revelation taken to the max, not even out of the experience at all of the writer, because it's something that very few writers in that part of the world would have ever even known anything about. Verse 31, can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? What are the Pleiades? Yes, Belinda. It's a constellation. It's a series of six stars, and they're named for the daughters of Atlas. And they're being pursued in the sky by another constellation, Orion. Now, Orion is the hunter with the three stars together that form his belt. And what this is a way symbolically of saying is, can you do anything concerning the control of these constellations? Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Verse 32, it looks like that it looks like that all that the ESV did was just say, let's transliterate the Hebrew and go on. Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season? And that was a name of a constellation, they think. And then there's the bear. Can you guide the bear with its children? These are constellations. This is not endorsing in any way astrology or anything like that. It is simply appealing to the names for the constellations that were not only known in those ancient days, but that are known by us and that we still use in speaking of the locations of these particular stars. And the idea is that it is God who leads them forth, God who guides them. Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you establish their rule on the earth? In other words, this is speaking of God's natural law. This is speaking of the things that He does to ordain what happens in the heavens and the earth. Now, in verse 34, there's almost a little bit of humor here. When God calls for rain, He being a spirit doesn't get wet. If Job did, he would. He says in verse 34, can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? There's a picture here of Job getting splashed with water that he would call on. But of course he can't do that. He can't lift up his voice to the clouds and command them. Then there's another funny picture here in verse 35. Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? He cannot control the rain coming down. He cannot command lightnings with unerring accuracy. He cannot do these things like God. In verse 36, we have here pretty much an untranslatable verse. Probably the ESV is about the best guess, and the NIV has something very similar. Who has put wisdom in the inward parts are given understanding to the mind. And, of course, this is something that only God has done. The words are very unusual. Inward parts is very similar to the word, you teach me wisdom in the inward parts in Psalm 51:6. The word for mind is a completely unknown word, and some people have thought that maybe it is it's similar to a word for a bird. It's similar to the word for a rooster, and the idea was that some rabbis thought that roosters crowing predicted rain. And anyway, just so you'll know, it's a difficult verse, but certainly the ESV makes sense. Who has put wisdom in the inward parts or given understanding to the mind? That is the Lord. That is our God who has given us our ability to think, our ability to reason, our ability to comprehend things. Who can number the clouds by wisdom? Here's an interesting image. Who can tilt the water skins of the heavens? It's like those wine skins that we read about so often in the Bible. These are water skins. They were the canteens that were used by travelers. And the rain is compared to God tilting water skins out of the heavens. And this happens in time of drought, when the dust runs into a mass and the clods stick fast together. Any comment or observation about all these passages concerning His sovereign control over the universe, over nature, over the rain, the thunder, the lightning, the stars?
It's probably getting on hit lightning, but it's amazing to me that with all the technology we have today, we still can't make it rain.
That's right. Yeah, we still can't make it rain. There's another thing, too. we're getting better, of course, in our ability to forecast the weather, but how many of you have failed to bring in plants on certain nights that all three weathermen said, it won't freeze tonight? And it did. You see, there's still always going to be limits to human knowledge, and it is God who is in ultimate control of the weather and the hurricanes and the storms. Now God switches to the animal kingdom. Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their thicket? If you're like me, you might have the response, I didn't know anybody had to do that. I didn't know that anything was involved except the law of nature, red in tooth and claw. I didn't know that there was any divine guidance over lions and other beasts of prey. And yet it says here God hunts the prey for the lion. He satisfies the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their thicket. And finally in verse 41 he says, who provides for the raven its prey when its young ones cry to God for help and wander about for lack of food? Isn't that an interesting phrase in verse 41, that the young ones are crying to God for help? There is a sense in which animals, in their open and sometimes loud confession of dependence, are bringing more honor to God than human beings who repress their knowledge of Him and who consider themselves to be self-sufficient. Well, this brings us to the end of chapter 38. What would it say to you if you were suffering?
I don't know as much as I thought I did.
That's right. And you would say, there is more to this world than me. There is more to this universe than my own problems, however big they have been. And there is more to God than His concern for me and my agenda with Him. Francis Anderson, one of the great commentators on Job, comments on the fact that God seems to sidestep the issues that have dominated the book up to this point, because there's no reference to Job's experience or his problems. And it's not revealed that God put Job to a test. And this is what he says, and I think it's a great comment. It's one of the many excellences of the book that Job has brought to contentment. To contentment. Without ever knowing all the facts of his case. In view of the way in which the Satan brought up the matter, something had to be done to rescue Job from his slander. And the test would work only if Job did not know what it was for. God thrusts Job into an experience of dereliction to make it possible for Job to enter into a life of naked faith, to learn to love God for himself alone. God does not seem to give this privilege to many people, for they pay a terrible price of suffering for their discoveries. But part of the discovery is to see the suffering itself as one of God's most precious gifts. To withhold the full story from Job, even after the test was over, keeps him walking by faith, not by sight. He does not say in the end, now I see it all. He never sees it all. He sees God. Perhaps it is better if God never tells any of us the whole of our life story. Would you say amen to that? Got another great comment too, by Elmer Snick. I thought this was quite notable. He said, Job had many questions to put to God, as do we all. instead of God's trying to prove that it is an explainable world, and that's what we always try to do. That's what we try to do when we counsel people and make things all right. We try to explain everything possible, and we are rational beings, and we think that that will do it. But instead of God's trying to prove that it's an explainable world, however, He insisted that it is stranger than Job had ever imagined. Yet in all the strangeness, there is brightness and joy and opposition to evil and wrong. And the reader comes to understand that in a world of such paradoxes, Job was suffering not because he was the worst of men, but because he was one of the best. Indeed, he was a grand type. In all his wounds, he prefigured the wounds of that one who was the only truly holy man ever to live, Christ the Lord. We'll continue when God issues another challenging question next week. Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? And who has let the wild donkey go free? Do you give the horse his might? And most important of all, that ostrich, which is one of God's most amazing creations. Do we have prayer requests tonight?